This is the App Hour Podcast, recorded February 27th, 2012. Episode 84, with guest Bunny Huang, Bunny's Bibolo Bonification.
Welcome to the Amp Hour. I'm Dave Jones from the EEV blog.
And I'm Chris Gammel of Chris Gammel's Analog Life.
And I'm Bunny, and I'm self-sponsored.
All right.
Well, excellent. Welcome,
Bunny.
Welcome aboard, Bunny. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, it's good to be here. Thanks.
And I'm sure everyone knows who you are, Bunny Huang.
Yeah. I guess.
That's all you have to say. Well, you pretty much only have to say Bunny, and everyone knows who you're talking about in this business anyway, so... You're pretty famous.
I guess so. I mean,
infamous.
I, Bunny's my handle, so I just go by. Hey, it's a bunny, right? So,
yeah, right. I actually had an interesting experience with that. I was having drinks with a friend who has a startup, and I mentioned to him, I'm like, oh, you know, like telling him about the podcast, how that's going, and I'm like, yeah, we have this guy on this week who hacked the Xbox. And he's like, oh yeah, Bunny. And I'm like, whoa, what? I didn't, you know, this is a friend who's, you know, he's a management kind of guy. And I'm like, oh, you know Bunny. You must have, like, you know, read his book or, you know, you must have know about the electronics work he does. And he's like, no. My mom taught him violin back in Michigan. And I'm just like, what?
Yeah. Crazy small world.
Oh, man. That freaked me out.
Yeah. That's ridiculous.
Yeah. I was like, that was like a blast from my past when you told me about it. I was like, whoa. I totally remember them. That's awesome.
It was great. Know. Yeah. It was really cool. And he said he remembered, you know, like, he got to see some of the stuff you were working on back then even, and he was in awe of your work.
Yeah, there was a little bit of, this was back in high school, there was sort of this decision point I had to make where I had a very good violin teacher, and she sort of is very serious about the art and told me at one point, like, you have to make a choice. Either you're going to go into engineering or you're going into music because you're not spending enough time in music and so on and so forth. And so there was this kind of moment where I had to sort of think, you know, do I really want to be a violinist or do I want to, you know, go into engineering?
Yeah.
And I decided to go into engineering. So.
And yeah. we're happy about
well
that.
Done.
Yeah.
Well, here I am. So.
Yeah.
Good choice. Correct choice.
Any music still in your life these days? I mean,
Totally. I mean, music is a huge part of my life. I mean, I think violin itself was instrumental in some ways to personal development. There's a lot of emotional development. Chamber music was great in learning how to work with people. A lot of discipline from the practice, and then just I have a huge amount of enjoyment from listening to music and the experience I get from it. So yeah, it's like I sort of have these audio tracks I listen to when I'm working, and I have like these special tracks like Liquid Work, right? If I really need to get something done, I just plug them in, I just tune out, and like my mind just gets in the zone. And so music has a huge impact on my mood and my focus. So it really is important to me.
Yeah, I have a troubleshooting playlist on Spotify. It's just the one that I go to whenever I I'm at the bench and, you know, need to.
I must be the odd one out here. I can do that all without music. You know, I can get in the zone and.
Wow!
I'm sure you're singing inside your head, Dave. Come on, you're probably singing.
Right. On the live thing the other day, I was whistling the Indiana Jones tune.
Yeah,
you know,
I was
building my MakerBot.
Nice.
So
nice.
Yeah.
Oh, there you go. It helps. Yeah, I can dig it.
So post Michigan, you're an MITer, right? I mean,
I spent 10 years there getting 3 degrees, which is pretty sad.
I'm sure a lot of people say that, right?
Well, no, I mean it's just, you know, I sort of hid in this little corner of the world, this little ivory tower. I actually went back to get my PhD after going to industry for a year because I was totally disillusioned.
Really?
All through undergraduate and master's, I was like, oh, I'm going to work for Silicon Graphics. I always wanted to work on graphics, visualization, and computers, and so excited. I got the interview, got the job. And after 6 months of working there, the cubicle farm was like so empty, so decimated that I had to walk around to like turn on the lights because what happened, everyone from SGI in my group had gone to these little startups called NVIDIA and ATI, which
I've
were,
heard of those.
You know,
right.
Yeah, you've heard of those now, right? But, you know, yeah. Back then I was just a new guy who came along like, where did everyone go? Everyone just left, right?
Guys?
And so after the end of...
the echo.
Yeah. After the end of a few months and sitting there totally by myself in this empty building, essentially, with like a couple of other people trying to struggle to get a chip out, I was like, this is lame. I guess I'll go back to school and figure out what I really want to do.
Yeah. I think a lot of people would have made that decision. I mean, like that's a tough first jump.
Yeah. So. Yeah. Yeah. And so I went back, and so it was sort of like this, actually getting my PhD is the best years of my life. I just totally like, I was like, you know right. what? Everything everyone told me in my entire life was wrong. I need to figure out what my life really is. And so I spent a lot of time just, you know, with personal, not, you know, because, you know, in undergraduate and graduate and master's, it was just like grades and focusing on like projects and just trying to, you know, just get the A and that sort of thing. And yeah, that turns out actually to be really irrelevant. You know, that was like, and then graduate student, I had this awesome PhD advisor let me do what I want to do. And I just sort of like, you know, woke up at 3 p.m. every day and sort of like, you know, went out and went to the bars and chased women and did all those kinds of things. And then, you know, sort of, you know, found a lot more about myself along the way. So that was really important.
Mm-hmm. And then, yeah.
And what did you end up doing as your PhD?
I did a PhD in computer architecture. So we, you know, sort of looking at massively parallel machines. The question was, so this is in 2001, you know, mm-hmm. roll the clock forward 10 years and look at where Moore's Law is going to be and what the limitations are and what kind of computer would you design that in that scenario and what would the new paradigm be? And so it's a little bit of crystal ball gazing and simulation and bits and pieces and trying to come up with, you know, what things would look like at that time.
Were you correct back then?
That's a good question.
Forward?
Yeah. It's the good news is, I mean, Moore's Law definitely moved along the way we had generally predicted to go. I had in my thesis, you know, generally, you know, multi-core was definitely going to happen, and that did happen. And the, you know, the primary limitation systems was going to be, you know, memory bandwidth, latency. And those are all real today. I was thinking there would be more architectural innovation to try and address these things. So there'd be new programming paradigms and languages that would help with parallelism and multi-threading and, you know, continuations and all these different things. That didn't happen as much. There's still doing a lot of traditional things and using the cores rather inefficiently today. So,
so you were saying, you know, even move away from the standard kind of like Harvard architecture, that kind of stuff, and move into whole.
Yeah.
New...
Well, I guess the thesis had proposed was the idea of the thesis was to propose an architecture that is alternate that would help address these issues. So, you know, I don't want to go too much into details of it because I mean, it's, you know, a lot of stuff to talk about, but basically the idea was that the idea was to create a very massively multi-threaded kind of execution paradigm where essentially you can take stack frames and migrate them from CPU to CPU. So you could have like 1,000 CPUs, say, inside of a box. And the idea was that it was actually faster to migrate the register set. So the register state itself would be, you know, 30 registers or 60 registers, however many it is, compared to the thread state, which could be a bunch of heap data and a bunch of stack data. And so if you had a thread running on the wrong CPU, you would pay a lot of latency getting to that memory that's far away. So your question was, do you want to move the memory or do you want to move the CPU? And so the idea was that we'd actually move the CPU closer because the CPU state's actually quite compact compared to the memory. And so it was a system that was designed that would allow you to very quickly and effectively migrate the CPU state between, you know, to where the memory was, basically.
First responder model kind of. It's like whoever's closest.
Yeah, sort
that
of
kind
like,
of
yeah. And there's a bunch of stuff in resource allocation and, you know, online processing to figure out was, you know, when do you do the move and when was it, you know, worthwhile and when would you lose and all this theoretical crap that, you know, PhDs, you know, that,
that
no one ever really cares about in the end.
So when did you get in silicon?
So silicon actually was again, you know, my whole life has been this sort of random walk of different things. I like to say I get myself a new PhD every 4 years anyways, whether or not it's in school.
Yep.
So when I graduated, I didn't do anything at all with computer architecture, because that field, essentially, one of the conclusions I got in the PhD was that there's computer architecture is a dead field. There's been all these great papers on it, but no one ever builds anything because Intel's just so good at building chips, right? Why would you spend four years of your life labor on something, and by the time you got it out, it was out of date because Intel had built something that was 8 times faster than what you had started with, right?
Yeah,
right. And they always play on the process efficiencies too, right?
Yeah, so they just... yeah.
So, and is that why they don't make any big changes, you think? Like the stuff you were talking about. Is it because they just want these little incremental changes? They don't want to take risk on a huge, big, you know, to change the entire way that the processor works? As you said, moving the processor around closer to the memory instead of vice versa, that's
spot on. I mean, backward compatibility, running your code that you have today, mm-hmm. and just trying to, you know, turn the crank of Moore's Law and just get the process a little faster. I mean, that is just, yep. I mean, it just totally makes business sense, right?
And business, yes. Money.
There's the game. That's the entire game, right? Is having to play that. Yeah.
Absolutely.
So there's almost no room for innovation, almost.
Right.
Like major innovation.
Right. That's right. Moore's Law has sort of compressed innovation into this very narrow window of time where essentially you have to do the whole stack within, you know, months these days, maybe years at best. If you have to show an improvement that's compelling in that period of time. There is this sort of little mini paper I wrote in my blog about the slowing down of Moore's Law. And the slowdown of Moore's Law is relatively inevitable, in my opinion. Because, you know, there's physics and that's going to slow things down. And once Moore's Law actually starts slowing down, you're going to start seeing a resurgence in innovation again in things like computer architecture and other areas. So I think there's going to be a healthy sort of like, not really a rebirth, but sort of a renaissance of good ideas coming out again that can come on play once, you know, the juggernaut of Moore's Law actually loses some steam.
And that's purely because the cycle times will now be longer. You have more freedom, I guess, you've got a longer amount of time to prove that something is viable rather than.
Yeah, so if you
got it.
Okay. Sorry?
I was going to say that happens these days with silicon in the analog world too, with the, you know, when they run out of silicon stuff on a node, when they run out of juice, they start looking at packaging until they finally make a jump, and packaging becomes the limiting factor then.
Yeah, you start seeing people move into other areas of innovation than silicon, and so if you get to the point, say, where you knew that the laptop that you had is not going to get any faster for 8 years because the last 8 years it didn't move anywhere, and there's some big jump and you got the new one, you're like, okay, well, so, you know, my machine isn't getting faster, it's not getting more RAM, what do I do? Well, I could spend 4 years developing, optimizing compilers and code things. I mean, that's a good bit of time, right? I mean, but, you know, 4 years is huge, right? And so all of a sudden you start thinking more, a little more differently about optimization. You know, hand coded assembly routines actually start making sense now because you get, you know, big performance gains out of it. And you know, you could start actually talking about doing architectures that require a lot of, you know, manpower investment and time, you know, and it's like, you know, I think the world will get actually a little more interesting for the small innovators in sort of a, what I call post-Moore's Law space, because, you know, the big companies like Intel and so forth are, you know, kind of, well, you know, what do? We can't keep on turning the crank anymore, but we'll see what happens.
And we've seen, you had a talk on that, didn't you? Was that at the Open Source Hardware Convention?
That's right. Yeah. And then the talk's thesis was that, you know, open source, the slowdown Moore's Law would be good for open source hardware and innovation because, you know, there's going to be more of a value on sharing and you have more time to build community between cycles. And it would make more sense to consolidate around open platforms like, you know, open chassis for laptops and so forth, because right now you'd be crazy to sort of build an open laptop chassis because every 2 years or 1 year the heat sinks change and the socket formats change, everything changes quickly. But when things sort of slow down a bit, you can sort of say, okay, we're going to invest in, like, you know, this common tool that everyone can use in a mechanical form factor. We can start building, you know, plug and play around this. A lot of things change, I think.
So. I remember when cool. right after that talk came out, we had contested some of your points in there, but I feel sheepish that we don't have them up now.
Yeah, that's right. I remember that. I don't remember details, but I remember us doing that. I don't think we entirely agreed, perhaps.
Yeah,
in some aspect of it. But
that's fine.
Yeah, I can't remember.
Let's see if I can find it. But
yeah, that would be embarrassing.
I would love to debate it if you have some alternate points of view. I would love to hear it. So.
Well, I think one thing that's interesting about that is, like, when you do reach that point where Moore's Law slows down, you start to move into, like, lower cost everything anyways, right? Because you start having efficiencies in mm-hmm. manufacturing, whatever else. Mm-hmm. And at that point, you start seeing innovation, not necessarily in, like, the design space, but you see it in the use space. So if now a chip was, $100 to start with and it goes down to $1, right? Someone mm-hmm. might just throw 10 of those chips on a board, right?
Absolutely.
That gets a whole different architectural view, right? That's a little different then.
Right.
So,
right. But that again sort of favors, more of like this, like it used to be, if I'm going to put 10 of these chips on the board, that would be a multi-month process to put 10 chips on the board, and you have to bring them up and get it working, get the software going on. By the time you actually got 10 chips on the board working, a lot of times you already had 10 cores on the, or 10 times the CPU power, right? Mm-hmm. and you'd sell your mm-hmm. system, people like, why would I want your 10 chip thing? It's 10 times more chips,
oh, true, yeah.
10 times more power, it's 10 times more expensive than my one chip solution. And so, I totally think that, now when you're starting putting 10 chips on the board, that really favors, again, like, small entrepreneurs getting together to build these kinds of things, which is, putting more chips on a board is a sort of a thing that individuals can do. Putting more transistors in silicon is a thing that only mm-hmm. companies can do, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
So
true. So tell us how you got started in the hardware business. Was Chumbi the first hardware thing you were actually involved with actually producing, or was there something before that?
Well, so I guess producing is a question. What do you mean by that? But I'll give you the answer that
making something available for a mass,
right?
Like outside,
more than just doing it for yourself, not actually doing a one-off, getting involved in the production side of electronics manufacturing and all
right.
that sort of thing.
Right. So Chumbi was the first, one that you actually heard of. I've had a long series of, failures in my past, and I continue to keep on failing, which it seems to be one of my specialties.
That's a good thing.
Yeah. And so when I first got out of, this SGI, which was a failure, and then that was supposed to be something that people could use. I worked for a company called Mobilian doing 802.11 BG chipsets. So it was my first taste into silicon. I was designing the analog back-end chip. I was on that team doing a little mixed signal design. Did that for a couple of years. That company went under. And then from there, I went to a company called Luxtera, which does nanophotonic integrated circuits. So we're building, 40 gigabit per second DWDM. Optical multiplexers on a single piece of silicon using some gnarly silicon process stuff. That's when I really got in the silicon side of things. And all these things were ultimately meant to go into production. So, in the process of doing silicon design, you actually get exposed to a lot of really good discipline around testing and validation. And the extremely high costs of running silicon puts a huge amount of emphasis on the design validation front end before you ever tape out a chip. You can't afford to spend $1 million and be like, oops, it doesn't turn on. Let's have another $1 million to do it again,
sure.
Right?
Yeah.
It's very hard to patch chips too as well. So it's like, right.
V equals IR. Damn it. I got it again. Every time.
Resistive drop. Oh, we should have made the bus wires bigger for power. Dang. If only I had run the simulation on. Anyways. So, you try to avoid that.
Yeah.
So it was sort of like this, Luxtera was sort of this phase I had of sort of chasing the coolest technology in the world. And I got a paper out of that in ISCC, which was awesome. And then, there was no money in it, right? It's sort of like, if I could make a 40 gigabit Ethernet chip for you today, you would pay 50 cents more for it in your laptop, because you already have a gigabit thing and you don't have anything 40 gigabit to plug it into. And what's the incremental value of 40 gigabits? I mean, it's kind of
marginal, you know? Utility, that whole thing.
The whole market for 40 gigabit Ethernet is sort of dominated by people who actually have dark fibers going to the home that can support single mode, you know, and that's like, you know, not a lot of people, right? So driving the cost of those down by a factor of 1,000 did not amplify the market by 1,000. It was a bad, bad business in the end.
Well, unless you sell the fiber along with it, right?
We had rights of way around the world for fiber, after kind of, you know, getting a little frustrated with that enterprise, I decided, you know, the opportunity came along to join Chumbi, and that was just more of a business focused play, right? And so consumer electronics, build stuff, put it out there, you know, low cost. And I was like, you know what, you know, it's definitely time definitely put something in the market, right? I just can't keep on doing these hero projects that never actually make it to market, right?
So Chumbi wasn't something that you started. It was already around and you joined them. Is that how it worked?
Yeah, I'm part of the founding team, but really, the person who sort of got us together was the lead investor, and so he was he's a great guy. I love working with him, and he basically sort of had these dinners once a week where he sort of got a bunch of people together. We talked about, you know, sort of the future of wireless, right? So this is back in the day when, when we started Chumbi, the best thing you could do with Wi-Fi was replace the Ethernet cable on your laptop. There's nothing else you would do with Wi-Fi. It's like, okay, you know, what's the value of this $200 box and you've got to walk around your house? And so the observation was like, you know, what if you could put like this Wi-Fi thing on the wall that could like deliver web content to you? Like, oh, that's really interesting. What would I do with like a Wi-Fi powered alarm clock or Wi-Fi powered picture frame, right? And so we started, you know, riffing on that and trying to develop, you know, sort of app store paradigms. And this was all before, like, you know, iPhone came out and stuff. Yeah. And
so what your time frame was it?
It was around 2005, I think.
Okay.
Yeah, 2006-ish. Like, it was a year before the iPhone came out, I remember, or maybe a year and a half. And when the iPhone came out, that was a big sort of turning point for our business, because we're like, okay, well, there's apps. It's in your pocket. It looks pretty good. So we had to sort of, you know, pivot on the business model at that point in time. And then, you know, there's the financial crisis of 2008, which basically put everyone in life support mode in you know, small businesses who were struggling at the time. But you know, as part of the thing, you know, the team was primarily software guys. It was four, you know, basically software people, business development guy, and then me as a hardware guy, kind of like, you know, trundling along the side. They said, yeah, you know, I can build hardware, you know, just let me at them. I'll go to China. I'll figure it out. And they were willing to trust me to do that, which is awesome, because at the time I had no credential at all of being able to do it. I was just figuring it out, bumbling around in the dark. And so I hopped on a plane, went out to China, talked to some manufacturers, figured it out, got the supply chain together, built the hardware, blah blah blah, and you know, now you know about Chumbi, and you can you can buy one and use it. And that was great. I mean, it was really, you know, I can now say that I really built something in a good volume, and I can say that, you know, it was good statistics on the yield, and I've had to deal with returns and reverse logistics and the whole kind of business. That end of things was really great exposure to that.
So how many Chumbis did you end up
selling? Yeah, I was going to ask that too.
I think, you
roughly,
know,
I mean, no exact
numbers. I think all told about like 100,000 or something like that. It's not, number.
That's still pretty good volume. That's, you know, for a niche sort of product.
Yeah. It's big enough. Discounts. Yeah, it's big enough that there's good statistics can be said, you know, solid statistics can be said about the production quality.
Ooh, Sigma, right?
Right. Yeah. You can start saying things about this. You know, if you build 100 and you say, oh, I have like, you know, 5% success because only 5 failures. There's 100 units, right? What can you say, right? When you build them on lots of 10,000, right, you can really start saying more.
Yeah, unless you get through a couple reels and start seeing the shift between reels, you're not really.
Right. Yeah. So that we got to that point where we're starting, you know, going through multiple reels of components on the line and start to see process shift dealing with, you know, underlife and obsolescence and all these kinds of crazy things that you have to deal with, which is great, and to sort of get that exposure.
That's when you're supposed to run away. That's no fun at all.
Well, I really wanted to, I think that was part of my personal goal in Chummy, was really sort of to be able to pick up any box, and I can, first of all, look at it and say, this is how it was made, really.
Yeah, that's cool.
And to say, this is how you would do it. And so I also learned, like, injection molding and plastic design as part of, while I was at Chummy, that was really also a great thing to pick up as well. So,
yeah. Was that your start of living? Because you now live in Singapore, is that right?
Yes, I live in Singapore now. That's right.
Is that a life decision, like a career decision, life decision?
Yeah, it's
why the shift from the US?
Yeah, I would say, basically the observation was I moved while I was at Chummy, and the observation was I was spending 3 months a year anyways in China. And there's one of these things about working with factories in China is that they always know that no matter how bad they screw up, you got to hop on an airplane and it takes like 2 days to get there and it's a couple $1,000s of overhead. And so they always had this sort of long leash to kind of muck around a bit, right? I come to Singapore.
What you going to do about it?
I'm in the same time zone now. I'm 3 hours away. And a very cheap plane ticket. So, if they're not behaving well, they know I'm going to be there, on their doorstep within a few hours, right? So, So I think, it really sort of helped get me more into the thick of the manufacturing, which I really want to get into. And the other thing, when I first went to China, is I discovered Shenzhen in electronics market. And I was like, oh my God, this is the center of my universe. I didn't realize it.
I remember seeing your post on that. And I remember I probably sent that post to like 20 different people and just being like, oh my God, you have to see this.
Yeah. I mean, it's a
bone in a
box.
07, I think
it's
you
awesome.
Posted that. Was that right?
Sorry?
Was that 07 you posted that? That Shenzhen video? Maybe earlier.
I don't remember when. I can look it up, but it was a while ago.
It's okay.
It was a few years back.
I remember looking at it, though, and just being like, yep, he made the right choice.
Well, why Singapore instead of Shanghai or Shenzhen, right in the middle of the...
Yeah.
Well,
I would say it's one of those things where I'd spent enough time in China to know that if I lived in China, I would kill myself. Like I would work too hard. I would drink too much. I would like something would happen to me if I was in China. Cab rides alone would probably kill me, and people just don't ride.
Die slowly over 20 years from air pollution, that kind of thing.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. I wanted to get close enough to it to be able to influence it, but not so close that I was, swimming in it.
And giving up a lifestyle. I've been to both places. I would much rather live in Singapore than Shanghai or Shenzhen any day.
And
so a lot of your manufacturing's in the Shenzhen area, is that right? I mean, you have to tell us where, but
that's
the hot spot, right?
Yeah, it is the hot spot. I mean, pretty much every, it's ground zero for every, Dongguan, Guangzhou, Shenzhen area, everything, that's the center of the manufacturing world. Yeah. It's amazing.
So how often did you have to make the trip there? You said you were spending 3 months a year there or something. Was that like you'd go there for 3 months and park yourself there and watch a production run, or were you just flying back and forth?
A thousand paper cuts. It was like, 2 weeks at a time, 3 months a year.
Frequent flyer miles like crazy. Not worth it.
I had an insane amount of frequent flyer miles. I don't even want to talk about how many of those cards I have now. And I'm starting to lose those now that I'm out here. It's I don't fly as much anymore. But
but at that point, you don't want to use them because you've been on a plane so much, right? I'm going to fly China. Like, come on, guys.
The last thing I want to do is get on a plane.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Oh, boy.
So
I can certainly understand it because I just I think we talked about this a couple of weeks ago. Here I was going to go to the US. Now I've decided not to go to the US, just because.
Well, as Dave said, it's 40 hours a plane, which is exactly a work week, which I had never thought of before, and that's crazy.
Just to get there and back is an entire work week.
It is.
It's just Yeah, it's crazy.
And then there's the disruption of your sleep schedule and all that sort of. Although one thing I have to say.
I had to weigh up the benefits, you know. And
One thing I have to say on airplane rides is I do get a lot of work done because I'm forced to be unplugged for about 24 hours total, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And then during that period of being unplugged, I get a lot of board layout done.
I was doing board layout on a plane the other day. I was flying home from Arizona.
See, I can't do that. I can't sleep on planes and I can't work on planes.
Really?
I'm just going to want to entertained. I just want to be sitting there like a zombie watching 10 movies back to back. Thank you very much.
No, I get on the airplane and I just start laying. I just get in the zone. I put in the liquid work, you know, you listen to the music, put in the headset, and just start laying out boards. And then, before I know it, you know, the stewardess is like, "Why don't you go to sleep? Everyone's asleep." I'm like, well, I'm getting the next time zone just by working through it, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And plus, as good as everybody else is asleep. Because then they don't give you the look, you know, like, oh, what's that guy doing?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, these kids would come up to me and they'd be like, "What game are you playing? Looks you're really into it."
You show them?
Yeah, I'd be like, "Yeah, this is called circuit board layout." And I'm using Altium, and so I'd like this 3D view, and I like start rotating around the circuit board and singly. It's like, "Wow, it's like Tron." I'm like, "No." It's all right.
Oh, that's great.
Oh, that's brilliant. Yep. Oh, there's a game model, if there ever was one.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
Sell a million copies. Right?
Yeah, right.
But there's another thing that always gets people to ask me questions. Am I doing 3D mechanical design in airplane? People love it, right?
Because
they actually watch me, like, you know, extrude things and cut holes, and they start looking like a real product by the time I'm done with the flight. And they go, like, "What are you building over there? That's really cool, right?"
I know.
I'm building a new part for the plane that's about to crash.
That's a good answer.
And I've got my 3D printer here. I can just churn it out.
It's in the overhead.
Make repairs on the fly.
That's right.
Oh, man.
So,
over in China, I mean, I had some questions just about, you know, when I see these videos in the market and everything in Shenzhen, and actually Ian from Dangerous Prototypes was over in Akihabara. And so I was watching that one too. And how often is it like, "Oh, I'm just going to pop down to the store and get another reel of resistor"? Is it like that, or is it just like what is the real function of that? Is it for manufacturing every day?
The open market?
Yeah.
Those open markets, yeah.
The open market is it's more like, "Yeah, I'm just going to pop down and buy a reel of resistors." It serves, you know, sort of designers and volume manufacturers, and then primarily the open market there serves in gray market components. So you'll find very few brand name things you can actually trust there. And gray market means things like, you know, manufacturer bought. No, they're not. It's not. It's gray. It's not
they
black.
They aren't necessarily fake.
Yeah, they're not fake. It's like, think, you know, manufacturer had to do 12,000 units and they had a reel of 3,000 left at the end, and they can't use that anymore after a certain date code has passed, and so they sell it to someone who will sell it for them. You go to the gray market and, you know, they'll sell you half reels, or, you know, if I want to buy 1,000 crystal oscillators, normally they're 3,000 to a reel. You can go to the gray market and buy them, just 1,000 of them. And the chick will just go there and she'll just pull her reel and go shh, and like all these like components come flying off. And she like pulls out a meter stick and like, "Okay, that's about 1,000 snips for you," sticks on the reel and says, "Here you go." You know, they're 8 cents a piece. You're like, "Okay, fabulous." Right. That's, you know.
Yeah, that is pretty fabulous. Yeah. And that's kind of like the analog over here is brokered parts. That's what they call gray market over here too, at least. You know, you go out to the network, to the internet, and you say, "Oh, there's 800 pieces." There's no guarantee to them, but, you know, they're there.
Yeah.
So if you want to try them, you know, you're welcome to.
Right. That's exactly right. Yeah. Yeah. And, of course, in the gray markets in Shenzhen, they're much less scrupulous about representing brands. So a lot of times you walk through these markets and you'll see people taking, like, they even do this for resistors. I was shocked. They were taking generic resistors, peeling the sticker off of them, and then sticking on like a Samsung brand on them. Like, they just sit there and like and you walk up and like, "I'd like to buy some resistors," and they're like, "Oh, would you like to buy some of these Samsung resistors?" I'm like, "I see you taking the sticker off of these generic ones and putting the Samsung brand on them, and you want to sell me them
as only 50%
brand name
more."
Oh, that's
amazing.
Brilliant.
It's awesome. Wow.
And so do you buy them?
I buy them, yeah. I mean,
yeah, right?
They were. Yeah.
No, why not?
I bargained the hell out of them. I'm like, these are not brand name. These are generic. And she goes, oh, yeah. You got me here.
Yeah.
$2 for the
So
real.
What about okay. bargaining? I mean, is it a lot of haggling and such like that too? I mean, could you get a tray of FPGAs for bare bottom prices kind of thing or what?
FPGA. So the market... FPGAs would be tougher. I wouldn't buy FPGAs in the market, to be honest, because they're almost always going to be not brand new parts. They'll be used parts taken off of existing assemblies.
Ouch.
Yeah, they do a lot of reballing and recycling of things. And particularly when you get to the more expensive components, like anything above like $10 for a component, it gets really dicey to buy it there. But wow. Like the other day I was searching for these LED strings that are waterproof that you can buy, the multicolor, you know, kind of reels and tape them on stuff. I had a friend who was looking for some of those. And so I walked around the market and shopped around and haggled people down, got like 30% off. And you know, ultimately, you know, the price I can get out there is better than any price you can get, you know, on the internet, you know, by a factor of two. But you definitely there's a lot of haggling that you do. You just sort of there's this one lady who has wanted to sell it to me for 90 RMB, and I walk around and then want to sell me for 75. I say, well, this person sold me for 75. Will you give it to me for? And they
okay. And that way it's just like a regular market. I mean, you can do that with fruit markets and everything else too. Yeah,
yeah, totally. Yeah,
How does the Singapore market compare to Shenzhen? Because I've been to Sim Lim Tower.
Yeah, Sim Lim Tower. Right.
Yeah, is the main one, isn't it, in Singapore?
Yeah, that's right.
That's the main.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think.
How does that compare with the Akihabaras and the?
Yeah, I would say the thing about the Singapore market is they sort of got locked in a time warp. If you want to go to the 1980s and buy,
that's the impression I got.
So and I think that basically what happened is they had a booming business in electronics here in the 80s, and then a lot of that migrated to China, and a lot of inventory got left behind in the 80s, and it's still on the shelf.
There's a lot of Z80 processors
there. Yeah, so when you hit your obsolete component, you know where to go, right?
Yeah.
I might call you for that.
Well, because a lot of the Apple clones and all the early microcomputer clones, they all came out of Singapore, didn't they? I think they were. That was a huge market back then.
They were just churning
out these. Oh, you're too young. Am I showing my age again? Am I?
Well, I had an Apple II clone, but I was of the age where I had not taken an airplane flight yet at that time.
Right. Oh boy.
Yeah.
So. Singapore. So we've got some. Questions.
Sure.
I think, don't we?
Audience questions, yeah.
Audience questions.
Our questions are crap, but audience questions are always good, so.
Sure.
A lot of people were interested in your FPGA experience. I don't know if you wanted to give a rundown of just kind of the stuff you've done in the past and how, I mean, people are asking about brands and stuff like that too, but, you know, like, it seems like a lot of your work is very heavily FPGA based, and just maybe your methodology behind it and what you like about them, what you don't like about them, and how you're using them these days.
Yeah, well, I guess, I mean, I love FPGAs. I mean, they're awesome as a designer to be able to use these things. You know, for a while I did chip design, so I didn't need to use FPGAs, but I used them for validation vehicles in chip design. I was in Chumbi, actually, I couldn't use FPGAs because they're just too expensive, you know, for a consumer electronics product. Except when I got to the NETV, when I was looking at costing out, you know, HDI transmitters and receivers, because of a quirk of the market, it actually turned out to be cheaper to an FPGA than buy two chips, right, and stick them on there for the HDMI stuff. So that actually made sense.
Yeah, I found that.
Yeah. So that actually made sense from the cost standpoint. And I was just super stoked. I was like, I'm going to put an FPGA in this thing. Damn it. I'm going to love it, right?
Badass, yeah.
Well,
yeah,
then you get the automatic upgrade path too, right? That's one of my favorite parts.
Yeah. So I was stoked to be able to put an FPGA in the design again. So I'm definitely prejudiced towards Xilinxes, and that goes a long way back. When I was in college, Xilinx was very generous and provided tools and parts, and you know, I did my thesis using Xilinx parts and so forth. And you know, I remember their generosity well.
Yeah,
I really, to this day, I really like working with their staff. And you know, I actually got a chance to meet with a bit of some of the Xilinx chip designers and the Altera chip designers back then. And one of the things that kind of struck me, I don't know if it's true today anymore, but back in that point, Altera was very focused on using FPGAs as an ASIC replacement, low cost, sort of like in that mid-volume ASIC tier replacement. Mm-hmm. So they were really shooting for low cost and sort of bare bone features. And at the same time, Xilinx is going more towards like reprogrammability, you know, partial reconfigurability, a lot more features and I/O and so forth in their devices. And and for me, like I didn't really care so much about replacing the ASICs. I really wanted a really feature-rich device that supported all these, you know, cool things. And so, I was really much more excited about, you know, the Xilinx philosophy overall back then. I don't know how it is today because I don't even look these days on the Altera side of the camp. Actually, to be honest, this is Altera guys. They're made to do something good. I don't know. I'll use the Xilinx part, right?
And that brand loyalty is very common. I mean, I talk to both salesmen whenever I talk to them, and they're just like, yeah, you know, we walk into these places, and it's usually just a crapshoot for them because it seems like there's Xilinx houses, there's Altera houses, there's Actel houses, and that's it. Yeah. You're just kind of, unless it's something special.
Well, it's not easy to move from one to the other. So, you know, on a brand new complex design, you're used to the architecture and the tools and the bugs and everything else
on
one brand.
It's the bugs you have to get used to.
Yeah, that's right.
That's right.
I got all this sunk cost. I have put so many reports in. God damn it, I'm sticking with it.
Yeah, yeah. You really
come hell or high water.
Yeah. I'm you get really used to the quirks of, like, you know, defining pins in one particular model, or, you know, the I/O standard problems, or the way the clock distributed network is like weird in this way, and you just know it, right?
Yeah,
like, I don't want
that's
to read another
quirk, but it's my quirk.
Yeah.
yeah,
it's a bit different with microcontrollers. I just haul myself to the cheapest brand, you know, whichever. I'm just designing something today, I'll probably do a video about it. I need a cheap microcontroller to drive an LCD. I go through my parametric search, which is the cheapest brand that'll do that.
Yeah.
I don't care whether it's Atmel, PIC, or TI, or bloody anyone else.
Or
just
if you went to
the
market, it would be the blank one, right, Dave?
Yeah, that's right. Whatever you can buy.
One hung low brand.
Yep.
Yeah. So, you know, because it's so easy to retool and reskill between microcontrollers, but FPGAs are, you know, order of magnitude more complex in their just the tools and the configuration and the learning curve.
Yeah. 8 gigabytes of my hard drive devoted to one version of Xilinx tools, right?
Yeah.
I want another 8 gigabytes of my hard drive for Altera, right?
Yeah. That's right.
Yeah.
Boy.
That's how they lock you in. They're just going to make a 100 gigabyte package, so you can't afford to put two tools on there.
They keep getting bigger. Last time I put one on, it was 13 gig if you knew everything.
Oh, that's killer.
You need to upgrade, bunny. Sorry, man.
Yeah. I'm using SSDs, so, you know, it's space is a premium.
Really? What do you do that for? I mean, is that for traveling? Is that kind of why?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a couple of things. I mean, the idea of having, like, this flying head, you know, a micron above, like, a cushion of air with a rotating disc just freaks me out, right? And
you know too much.
Yeah, magnetic, you know, go past a MRI machine, I lose all my data. It's just, you know, it's like, I love the robustness of the S, you know, I can toss my laptop now and not feel bad about it.
But you've got to be careful, though. Solid state discs don't use the lowest bidder parts from Shenzhen.
Right, right. No, I do spend a lot of money to get the brand name SSDs,
right.
And I back up constantly.
Oh, so you hope.
So I hope, right, yeah.
Right.
I do take them apart before I put them in to make sure that the parts look legit.
Really?
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
no,
I mean,
that's paranoia.
I'm about to put
that's justified.
Time and effort into this SSD. Yeah. I'm not gonna, you know, just trust the manufacturer that this thing I'm going to put all my life's work into is actually what they say it is. I'm going to look at it.
Right. Man. Right.
Yeah, fair call. Yeah.
And that actually brings up some of your other, I mean, so you've been running into this, do you own your own hardware kind of stuff, and you've been fighting against this, right, with your newest device, the NETV.
Yeah.
Can you tell us a little bit about the fight and what you've had to deal with?
Well, NETV wasn't, it's more of a, I guess more of a theoretical fight. I'm finding this, you know, nebulous enemy of, you know, that represents the DMCA and all these other different things. There's, like, basically the specter that hangs over a lot of
activities in the computer space where if you bump against anything that involves cryptography, you're potentially violating the DMCA because it could also be used to control copyright. And and that really put a crimp on innovation, and you can't open your box anymore, and it really sort of really changes the paradigm of how people interact with things. And really, you know, one of those times when you say like, geez, like this law is really hampering innovation. Cause you go to places like China and you say, okay, China has terrible IP laws and, you know, they're all criminals and they steal things. On the other hand, they have one of the most fecund market exchange for ideas. People just trading things back and forth. And I see the openness and the overturn of ideas there and how that's, you know, sort of propelling them forward. And I go to the US and I see people like, oh, well, I can't look at that because it's encrypted, or I can't touch that because it's closed, or I'm going to avoid the warranty.
Or you can't have the data sheet because it's whatever.
You can't have that data sheet. It's like, oh my God. Like, and it's just like just barriers. And when you're in an outright sprint, I mean, we are in a sprint for the top, you know, pole position in innovation. And you go ahead and you tie lead weights in your feet. Yeah, you're the best athlete, but you got lead weights in your feet, man. Like, you know, like it's not helping you, right? So,
yeah.
So, you know, I'm trying to, you know, and I think, you know, around the NETV in particular, the trouble with HDMI when I started. So let me actually back up a bit. I'll tell you a little bit where NETV came from, right? So,
please do.
We had built an 8-inch. Frame device in Chumbi a couple years ago, and it wasn't selling well because it's too expensive. And if you look at the BOM, the most expensive thing in the BOM is glass, right? LCDs are just freaking expensive with touchscreens on them. People want cap touch, they want multi-touch, and you just like tally it up and you're like, this is really expensive what people want. I can't build something that the market can bear. I go, okay, well, I want to get rid of the glass, right? I want to see how do I get rid of this screen. And so I start thinking, well, okay, everyone owns a great piece of glass called a TV. It's got a port I can plug into it.
Samsung has gotten that down really good.
Yeah. I mean,
big pieces of glass these days.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'm like, okay, well, what would Chumbi look like on a TV? I plug it in. You're like, okay, Chuck Norris quotes and 40-inch TV. Okay. That's lame after about 30 seconds.
All right.
You know, it's like, it sort of gets boring, right? Like, okay, that's kind of lame. And you're like, what I really want a TV for is I want to watch TV, not widgets. And so that means I want to be able to blend my app experience with TV, which means, okay, now I got to do an overlay, right? So there are two options at point was either do I, you know, put content in my box and try to do the blending before I put it to thing, or do I use someone else's box of content and overlay on top of it, right? Being a small company, we don't have content relationships. I can't actually get the right to do that. So the only option I had was to use someone else's content and overlay on top of it. And this is where things get hairy because the content's encrypted over the wire. So the reason why you haven't seen a product like NETV yet is because of that encryption. There's no real sort of legal way to do it without sort of running afoul of the DMCA. So one of the parameters of the product design became a way to do this that was DMCA safe. And so I did a little research on the cryptography and how things went. And of course the costing worked out using FPGA versus like, you know, actual receivers chips. And I came with a scheme where in fact we can do video overlay without ever decrypting the video. So the video itself stays encrypted the entire way through. We never decrypt it. We never load it into a buffer. Instead, we just swap encrypted pixels for newly encrypted pixels. And so even though we're intercepting the key exchange and we're reversing the keys and all that sort of stuff, because we never decrypt any video, we just use the keys to encrypt video. It's not a crime to encrypt video.
You have never seen the content.
Yeah.
It's not a crime if you haven't seen the content, right? Is that the...
Yeah, I mean, right. Well, the crime is to descramble data, you know, to defeat a copyright control mechanism. If you never descramble the data, the statute doesn't apply, right? Part of this law applies to what I did? And please point out to me. Thank you very much. And you can't actually point to any mechanism where this law could actually apply to. So it's a moot point, right?
So could I try and put it like into an analogy, like from how I understand it? It's like if you had a stolen package coming to you, right? And then you took that stolen package and you never opened it. Now, obviously, it's not stolen, but you put it into another box that has its own labeling. That stuff's all still in there, right? And then you add, you know, whatever else, a Twitter feed in with that box, and then you package that up and, you know, write stolen on the top of that box. Is that right? I mean, is that about how it goes?
Almost.
Oh, that's a big complex acre.
Yeah, maybe.
Thank you.
Yeah, I think the thing I would pick a bone with analogy is it's the package is never stolen, right? It's en route
right,
to the proper.
Have said stolen.
It's there. It's publicly available.
You send
right?
it to the person that it's going to in the end, right? The intended. Yeah. And the weird thing is that the package you're talking about, the intended sender and the recipient is the same person. It is your own DVD player going to your own TV. It's not like I am like nefariously stealing something that's going between my neighbor's, you know, cable box and my thing. Right?
You
own both ends of the link. Like you actually probably own the DVD they're using to play. You actually own the player. You actually own the TV, and you have this link in the middle where, you know, if I were to actually open this package, I'm saying to myself, it's a crime because you're not allowed to open packages at all, right? I mean, it's illegal to just open the package, right? It's ridiculous, right? And so a package I'm saying to myself across this cable is illegal for you to open. It's like, God, this is like retarded, right? Essentially it's more of like, you know, you have this package is actually thousands of packages that are going to the screen. Each of them is a pixel. Each pixel is a package. What you're doing is a package is going to yourself. You're just throwing away a bunch that you didn't want and putting ones you want in and just delivering them to the TV.
Yeah, that's a good way to say it.
And you know, as
how do you use the same encryption? How do you encrypt it the same as the already encrypted data?
So the HTTP mechanism is a symmetric cipher. The same key is operating on both ends of the cipher, and so there's this cipher text stream on both ends. So you have to deduce the state of the cipher. Based upon the initializations and match the cipher that you have inside the overlay to the one that's in the transmitter, time wise and state wise. Okay. And then once you're matched up, it's just an XOR operation. And then the receiver, because it's synchronized to both your state and the other transmitter state, doesn't care either. There's no link verification or anything like that going on, like checksums or anything like that. It just happily decrypts everything.
Right.
Yeah.
Got it. Clever.
Very clever. That sounds
and
awesome.
And you've been able to. So, have you had much heat over this, or is it?
Nah,
have they all sort of backed off straight away once they realize that you're not doing anything illegal?
I don't know. I mean, it's one of those things where I'm so small right now. I'm irrelevant, right? So it would cost them more to come after me, to be honest. I don't know. I mean, maybe there's some lawyer sitting in a den somewhere drafting up papers and a complaint against me. And okay, well they can come to Singapore and serve them to me. Right. But
if they're listening, they should not do that. If there's any lawyers that happen to listen to the Amp Hour.
Well, if they are listening to the Amp Hour,
yeah, they're probably, very different.
Well, the NTV is being manufactured by a company that I started in Singapore, partially because I want to make sure that the jurisdiction for whatever happens is on my side, right? I don't want to have to fly back to the US deal with someone serving me in the US. So, you know.
And the DMCA has power out there? I mean, I don't know anything about the legal
stuff. Well, I think they do. Well, yeah. They think they have power all over the globe.
Oh, watch out.
Seriously,
he's getting lined up for a rant here.
They do. they're pushing their boundaries into. It's the same thing with the whole U.S. government. They think they can control the world.
It started.
You know?
I shouldn't have said anything.
It started.
Dave,
you started
there.
It.
Okay.
As a non-U.S. person, we notice this stuff.
Yeah. There are treaties, and there's a bunch of things that happen that may make some things apply over here. It could end up being simply that they just block me in customs, right? They could say, you can't ship to the U.S. market because you have an injunction, right? So even if they couldn't get me a necessary on the grounds up here due to the local laws, they could definitely shut down my market access.
For sure.
And then I'd be stuck with a pile of inventory that I can't sell because the main market's the United States. That hurts, but the other thing, the nice thing about using FPGA is I can say, okay, well, you know what? The thing you didn't like, it's gone.
Exactly.
I don't actually do with HTTP anymore, so I can just sell these, right, without it in there. And then
It's just an sell it as an FPGA
right.
development
game. Yeah. You know, so now what are you going to do, right? You know, come on, you right. know, show me yeah. where the thing is yeah, yeah. that's violating your precious stuff, right? And yeah. and then you know, we can talk about it, right? And then when users get it, they can be like, this is source code I found on the internet and I compiled.
Well, that's like how it goes with even like MP3 stuff. I mean, if you download Ubuntu, you have to get certain encoders because they're not allowed to package them with
right.
with an Ubuntu installer. And it's like, okay, well, I guess right. I'll just go get it.
Wasn't this the same with the Xbox hack in the thing with the mod chips and all that sort of stuff? I think they, even in Australia here, they ruled that actually selling just the mod chip on its own was actually illegal. Which is nuts, you know.
Right, right. So,
but that's what it got down to. Like, even the source code was, you know, it's not the act of actually doing and pirating the thing, but actually selling, you know, even the
right.
you know, the device that allows you to do it.
And so there's some legal theory behind this, and one of the things that I think I'm not familiar with the details of the Australian case, but one of the arguments that is made is if the only viable purpose for something is illegal, the ownership of that therefore must be illegal. Like, why do you have like a nuclear bomb, right? Yeah. You know, there's no reason for you to have it. Therefore the possession of that is a crime. Right. So one of the really important things about NETV as well is that it actually, there is a non illegal viable commercial purpose for it. Right. That you can use.
Excellent. Is that by design?
But by design. Right.
Right.
And so, you know, you can object to it all you want, but you cannot classify it as simply contraband because of its sole existence. There's other things it can do. You would have to really argue before a judge and make your case that the only thing this is useful for is violation of some types. And so,
and then you get to bust into the courtroom and show them all the cool things it could do, right? Check this out.
Well, I never really want to go to court and fight any of this stuff. You sort of do an abundance of preparation ahead of time to sort of, you know, make it so that it's very difficult to actually bring you there.
Would it actually get to the point where you actually wouldn't sell it as the NETV? You would sell it as, you know, you would sell it pre-programmed with a game on it or something, or...
Yeah, I mean, it's
actually market it as something else, but nudge, nudge, hint, and wink, wink. Here's what it can be used for.
Well, I would never do the nudge, nudge, wink, wink. That would be illegal.
right.
It's
no,
sole purpose
let, no,
is to,
let, yeah. let other people do the nudge, nudge, wink, wink for you.
Yeah, as you know, I can't control people do with it at the back end, right? You know, it's free world.
Right.
So
yeah, that's right.
So,
that's right.
So,
you shouldn't be talking about the amp hour anyways if that's the case, right?
Well, Buddy Wang said it on amp hour
yeah,
3 years ago.
Yeah,
and,
there you go.
We have the right,
I guess,
Your Honor.
I see myself in court 2 years from now, like, why would I say that?
God damn it. Why did I talk to those guys?
Here I'm on the record now, and I'm listening to myself in the courtroom, putting my head in my hands like, oh, I shot myself.
But that microphone sounds nice.
So one of the things I'm doing right now actually with NETV is I'm actually retrofitting it into another design where it's kind of Frankenstein thing. It's merged with a bunch of like motor controllers and digital IO, analog IO, so you can use it. Actually, you know, the intention for this is to help control robots.
Yes, awesome.
Which sort of doesn't really make sense. Why would you have HDMI ports in a robot? Well, you know, if you want to put a monitor, it's long story. But
yeah, like telepresence kind of stuff, right?
Yeah, telepresence.
Yeah,
device,
there's a bunch
right?
of stuff you can do with it. I think actually, you know, it's one of those things where I need an FPGA anyway in this controller, and if I'm putting FPGA, I might as well put two HDMI ports on it, and you know, it's
yeah,
yeah, you know. So that product there may become what sort of, I think can survive any sort of legal challenge that may come up, you know, because it really has a ton of other purposes than a TV device. But
right,
yeah.
But it's sold as a TV device.
The NETV is right.
Right, and that may be the problem.
Yeah,
that's actually
the name of the any robot, right?
Yeah. I don't know. One of the things about the NETV itself is that, you know, the concept was originally to be, you know, done with Chumby, but Chumby's not really doing hardware anymore, so I'm building it myself. And as an individual, like, I'm now having to do customer support and help all these people. And so is this flood of email mm-hmm. going to my, you know, and so and there's a question of, do I really want to go into sort of a very consumery feeling market and you know, address all the concerns? I know very well how much it's going to cost to run support and do all this. Or do I really want to stay more with developers and hobbyists and you know, just yeah. that end of the spectrum? And so, you know, I feel, I want to be more on you know, working with makers and hobbyists. I really like those people as customers. I love customers who are smarter than me and tell me, you know, you did something wrong. Yep. And they, you know, I'm like, oh, well, that's
don't
great.
Worry, I fixed the FPGA, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Here's the patch. I'm like, well, yep. You're awesome, right? I love working with you, right? Versus like, oh, you know, I...
And they understand, you know, you've screwed things up, or it's going to take some time, yeah. or it's going to do yeah, this, or but please excuse me if I don't personally reply. Maybe asking on the forum might be a better way to get an answer or something
yeah,
like that. They
yeah.
sort of
a lot of people
understand that.
That's a lot more understanding at that level, not sort of like the scream on the phone, yeah. like, you know, why isn't my Wi-Fi working today? I'm like, ugh.
Is it on?
Yeah. Did you type in your
have
key
you
correctly? Is it case sensitive? Yeah. You know, it's
there's only so much you can handle with that. Yep, I get it too. Yeah. Yeah.
So you want to move more back into niche, hobbyist sort of maker field devices then?
Yeah,
is that more satisfying?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think. It's a little bit of an, I would say it's more like, I would rather have a couple of good customers who buy a lot of units. So like selling to like industrial, medical, you know, those kinds of people who right. need controllers, you know, good low cost systems, solid, good software stack, and support them really well. Right. And help them innovate. Rather than sell to like, you know, a million people each with a different configuration and try to figure out all the permutations, yeah. combinations of like receivers and TVs. And I mean, just the validation lab I have to buy to be able to replicate, you know, every combination of component would just kill me. Right. So, I think one of the things I sort of decided at the moment, I would rather be happy than be fabulously wealthy at this point in time, right? So, yep. You know, chasing riches and going for these big consumer products is great, but yeah, it's a ton of work and I'm a little tired, yeah. you know.
I don't think it's as satisfying.
Yeah.
Personally.
Yeah.
But then again, I'm just a nerd. Like, I guess you are and Chris is and everyone Yay. Else who's listening to us, no doubt. yeah. You know?
Those are the people we like, so yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, and it's yeah. sustainable as a business model in order to, like, you know, keep operating, right? I mean, that's what it ultimately comes down to. If you can make enough money at it to keep going, then that's...
Yeah.
No, that's all that matters.
We'll find out, right? But, you know...
But, well, everybody go buy one right now. Stop listening to this and go and buy one.
Yeah, yeah. But you know, I think the thing is, you know, if someone picks up and says, oh, I want to do like a digital signage solution. I mean, I think any TV would be great for like digital signage, right? It's awesome for, and for example, digital signage would be an awesome market for, because typically you have a very homogeneous installation of 1,000 different displays with, you know, one customer to deal with, and you really enable them to put smarts into a digital signage solution. That guy will buy enough volume to make the business, you know, more worthwhile, right?
Sure.
And so you kind of put out there and hope, you know, you're fishing. You hope you find the guy who has, like, you know, this volume deployment. And if they don't, that's fine. You still support them, help them. But, you know, they're all along the way, you're sort of building this corpus of knowledge and support that other people can rely upon. That's great. You know, that's what I'm hoping to do, you know, with this. And you know, it's a very modest goal. It's not crazy or anything like that. I think it's just, I just want to be an engineer, right, for a little while and have fun being an engineer, right?
Awesome.
Why would you want to be anything else?
No,
that's right. I got a question with you. I'm on your Hacking the Xbox, because you wrote a book called Hacking the Xbox. Yeah. Right. It's quite famous, I think.
Yeah,
probably.
I guess.
Was it the first reverse engineering, popular reverse engineering?
I don't know.
Book out there, maybe?
I haven't really done a citation search for reverse engineering books. But,
right. But your publisher, Wiley, they canned it, didn't they?
Yes.
Out of fear of the DMCA.
That's right.
Can you tell us about that? They were just, what did they just phone you up one day and said, sorry, we're not selling this anymore. We're scared shitless.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, that's about right. I mean, it was one of the weirdest things because, like, you know, they contacted me and they said, you know, we'd like to advance you a royalty to write this book. And I worked with the editors. It was great. Mm-hmm. And you know, typed away at it, you know, 4 or 5 months. Got the book written, sent the manuscript over, and then they re-ran it by the lawyers, and they says, nope, too risky. And I go, too risky? Like, really?
Oh,
and they
say, spent time on this, huh?
Yeah.
You should have done that.
But they were nice enough to let me keep the advance, right? Because they're like, well, you wrote the book.
Right.
It was a deal.
Yeah.
It was a deal. So I said, okay, well,
yeah.
I have this advance. How much does it cost to print a book? And I go, oh, okay. I can print books with this advance. Okay, so I took the advance and printed a bunch of books and stuck them in my garage and opened a website and says, I'll sell it, right? And
yeah,
and then start selling, and then fortunately, I mean, selling books is fun for a little while. Except at 2 a.m. again, you get these calls from people like, you know, I ordered this book 2 days ago and it didn't arrive, and I'm like, oh, and then they're like, you know, where's my book? I'm like, I don't know, man. I type my computer, and then after all, the guy goes, wait, I was expecting an operator. It's like, yeah. And it's like, are you Bunny? I'm like, yes. I'm like, it's like, oh my God, I'm so sorry. I'm like, what
do
you
thought you're
going to
say. He's like, oh, I just checked. It's in my front door. Don't worry about it, man.
So you know, it's like.
So you ended up self-publishing only. Is that?
No, for a little while I did that. And then, self-publishing was fun for a little while. But again, the 2 a.m. calls for people warning where the book was getting tiresome. And a really great guy at No Starch Press, you know, offered to pick it up. And I love his attitude. He's like, yeah, we do a bunch of books that are risky. I'm the boss. If I like it, I'm gonna do it, right? And I was like, yeah,
that's awesome.
This guy's got balls, right? So
yeah,
I'm gonna do it. Okay, fine. Here you go.
Yeah,
go for it. And so you know, he did it, and it was great.
Well, I can probably say it's not really confidential. Yeah, I've been approached by No Starch to write some books, and I'm not sure if I'm going to do it yet. If I have the time to actually do it, and whether or not it's beneficial and all that sort of stuff. So. Yeah,
and after all that video, Dave's not sure he remembers how to write. So,
yeah. Oh boy. So,
and no search.
Yeah, I don't know, but yes, they seem very good.
Yeah.
Yep. Okay.
So, with the Xbox thing, did you ever see a turnaround? Kind of like how the Kinect. I mean, I know the Kinect hacking kind of got a lot of flack from Microsoft, and they kind of turned it around. Did they ever come back to you at all, or did you ever have any interaction with them?
Yeah, there was. I mean, I think the. Sort of nipped this one at the bud. Basically, I mean, one of the nice things about being at MIT is that you have some really smart MIT faculty who are connected, and so they sort of connected me to the EFF, and I had a conversation with the EFF about what's the right way to approach this, and we sent some cordial letters back and forth to Microsoft, and basically before we ever really got to that point. There's a consensus that this was not going to be a problem for them, right? You know,
oh, that's great.
And
excellent.
That was great. I mean, I think that's you know, I wish more people would just have civil conversations about things before going to courts about it, or sending in a nastygram or something like that to make you go away.
Right.
But Microsoft in
cut
general
down,
has gotten much more enlightened about the hacker community. I mean, they have Blue Hat, and Microsoft is now like inviting hackers essentially to help them improve their products and so forth. And I think that served them well.
I agree. Well, cool.
Have we got any last minute questions, Chris? Because our amp hour is truly up. We've used up our capacity.
Oh yeah,
it just flies by.
It does. I saw a couple people ask this on the page that we had up for questions, and I was kind of intrigued too. Where did you get started with Marvell? I mean, because when I was getting electronics, I had never really heard of them. And then when I finally got to some conferences, they were like, they had a bunch of chumbies on their display and like, we got all this stuff. So what's the story with that?
So, Marvell came along. Actually, they found us, I think. They were looking for someone to work with in that space. They were just getting their sort of smart photo frame media tablet processor out there. We were looking for an outstanding CPU with, you know, really good cost performance, and you know, one of their you know, one of their sales guys came down and had a conversation. The price was right. Features look good, and we started using it. It was a business decision, right?
Okay.
And I think that's very Marvell sort of Marvell. I think is very, they're not sort of an open market provider. They go for verticals. You know, they sort of say we're going to get that guy, and we're going to like sick someone on him until he, you know, we make that sale.
He cracks.
This guy's the bunny salesman. Is that what it was?
Well,
you take him out to dinner until he buys one.
Get him drunk. Yeah. Take him to a bar.
Yeah. I'm easier than that. Just offer me the best price and I'll use it, right?
Yeah, that'll do it.
Yeah, exactly.
So was there any like NDA or anything like that? Because it seems like,
of course. I mean, Marvell is very big on the NDAs, and that, you know, that is sort of a sticking point when you're trying to do open source stuff.
It's almost to the point of being evil. A lot of engineers I know will not touch a device if you have to sign an NDA to get the data sheet. They just, it doesn't care how cheap it is, how good it is, they'll just say, no, I don't want to deal with those bastards because they won't give me a freaking data sheet.
No, it's true. It's definitely very painful to have to deal with NDAs. I think, you know, I'm a little more on the real politics side of things. Like, depending on the, like, for Chumbi is a consumer business model, right? I have a directive and, you know, to build the cheapest thing out there for the best price. And so, you know, the consumer ultimately didn't care that, like, 99% of consumers don't care that they can get the data sheet, right? There's like 1% who does.
Yeah, buying a hacker board, right?
Yeah, but they...
So you have to swallow your pride and
deal with it. You just have to do it, right?
Right.
So we did it, right? That was a business decision that we had to make. And, you know, I think there's any shame in admitting that, you know, most consumers don't care about it. And you're, you know, if $5 more for, you know, a free part versus $5 for an NDA part, the guy is, it's $5. They're just not going to give it to you, right, for the openness that they don't really benefit from. So you know, there's definitely parts I use that require NDAs and so forth. And the other thing is, like, there's just parts where it's, you know, eventually they will become non-NDA'd, you know. Eventually, just, it takes time. So I sign all kinds of NDAs to get early access, because if I wait until it's on free and full market, then I've lost my competitive edge, right?
Yep.
So I'll sign an NDA to get early access, you know, preliminary data sheets and so forth, and I keep them quiet. And then when
the same reason people use parts that are maybe not proven, right? I mean, there's always chances for bugs or errata and stuff, but you take that risk. Yeah, I mean, I get it from a practical standpoint.
Right. So. Yeah, so it's all part of the business landscape. And, you know, it's true. It definitely does make the support for the product more difficult, because they don't make the data sheet just out there, and I really wish they would. And I've had conversations with them about doing it, and they have people inside Marvell who understand this, and they have, you know, really big open source proponents, and they understand it. But there's a lot of competing business logic, you know, behind it, know, about why they want to do it. And you can agree or disagree with it. They're the guys who, you know, we're building the silicon, so
Do you see it getting worse, or I mean, obviously, I personally think it's getting worse. But do you see it ramping up even more? Have you been signing more NDAs in the past couple weeks?
No. I mean, I think now that sort of I'm designing for a different market. You know, I'm looking forward to some new chips looking at, and I'm actually really. I love the Marvell guys, but I'm also a really big fan of Freescale as well. And, you know, Freescale has, that's great. You can just go to a website and download the data sheet for their chips and so forth. They're a lot more easy to work with from that front. And so I'm making a conscious decision to steer myself more towards those, just because I do like that freedom and ease of low friction. And, you know, Freescale, you can actually buy in DigiKey, whereas Marvell, you can't, right? So there's a lot of, you know, but the market I'm going towards now, if I'm more towards developers and hobbyists, they really actually would pay more for a device where they didn't have to get an NDA.
Right.
And so I'm sort of realigning my design choices with the market that I'm really going after, which would be more developers at this point in time, as opposed to, you know, consumers.
Yeah. And I see on the hacker board that you actually did switch over to a Freescale IMX 233 or something like that.
Yeah. Sorry. Yeah, so that's a great part. Yeah,
that's cool.
And actually, that one to be honest, was a cost decision itself. I mean, MX233,
luck, huh?
Yeah, it was luck. It was,
yeah.
But I had in the process of using the Freescale parts, I had a great experience with their apps engineers and their sales guys, and sort of the ease of information flow was great. And so that's actually a big plus to me in this particular market.
Yeah, and it's good. I mean, hopefully other vendors take notice of that kind of thing. You know, if any of them are listening, we always talk about that too.
Of course they are.
We like that. So.
Yeah. No, yeah. It's a cost thing, right? I mean, ultimately, I think Freescale probably spends more on apps engineers and support costs because their parts are just downloaded by more individuals, right? But I think Freescale's parts are a little more expensive, partially because is kind of a built-in cost, what part of the cost of business. I think the Marvell parts really are very cost competitive, but, because they're very selective about releasing, who they're going to talk to or not, they can make their apps engineering support a lot thinner.
Yeah.
And staff is really expensive,
sure.
If you've got an apps engineer who's being paid, I don't know, what do you pay them these days? In Bay Area is probably six figures close to it, right?
Or more than that, probably, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, and think about if you're, you think about the volume of chips you're selling and how much going to have to amortize that guy's cost. It gets expensive, I think, after a while to sort of put all that staff on it. And so I can totally see the other end of the spectrum, right? And I also got really good support from Marvell as well, and they were really good guys. But it's because they kind of picked me, right, and wanted, made me a priority, mm-hmm. and that was great. I was lucky that they felt that way, but not everyone gets that sort of access, so they don't have as many opportunities. But then they develop that market more thoroughly. So,
all right, one last question.
Yep.
How did you get the name Bunny?
Good question.
Yeah. So it was in middle school. Monty Python and the Holy Grail has sort of just kind of come out at the time.
I already love where this is going.
And there's that the rabbit with
you bit someone's head
teeth.
Off. Oh my god!
that's a Vorpal Bunny, right? And one of my friends gave me the nickname Vorpal Bunny because we were playing this like hack text based game called Moria, Dungeons of Moria in the day, and there's a Vorpal Bunny kept on nuking me in the dungeon, and I kind of like the name, so for a while I was going by the handle Vorpal Bunny, mm-hmm. when I went to MIT they didn't have enough characters for Vorpal Bunny, so I had to pick Vorpal or Bunny, and I was like Vorpal, who knows what Vorpal is, Bunny sounds. Yeah, it's cuter, but who's ever going to call me Bunny, right? So it's just an email thing, right? No one used IM. Yeah. It was on Skype back in the days. This is like weird. You have to just go through this as part of the registration process. Okay, Bunny, BUNNIE. I'll make it the effeminate form too, right? Just because it's just so out there. Instant messaging came along. People just. Instant messaging comes along and people only see you by your IM name. So people start calling Bunny through there. And it really stuck when I had a professor who was TA for one of the core courses at MIT, and he couldn't remember my real name, and he introduced me as Bunny to a class of like 300 sophomores.
Oh no!
And at that point, I was like, what?
And they're in yep,
yeah, they remember that. Yep.
They remember that, right? They wouldn't forget it. And I was like, what? I give up. From now on, I am called Bunny, right? So there's actually a very clear demarcation. You can tell when. How long a person's known me based upon which name they call me by.
Yep.
Right.
So.
Oh, man. That's great.
Well, thank you very much, Andrew.
Yeah, right. Oh. We feel like we've known you a long time, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. The show's gone on for an hour and 22 minutes.
It's an unusual name to be called by.
Yeah, but.
Well, could be worse.
All right. Well, thanks so much for being on the show.
Thank you very much for joining
really
us.
Great.
It's been awesome.
It was fun. Thanks for having me.
Once again, our guest was Andrew Bunny Huang, and you can find him on Twitter at Bunny Studios or on the web at bunnystudios.com. You can find the Amp Hour on Google+, Twitter, and Facebook. Hoping to see you next week.
All right. See ya. And no audio dropouts or anything. That was
Singapore, well. Right? I have 100 megabit to my home, so it's great.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
Oh, yeah. Wow.
That's one of those details I left about why I'm here. 100 megabit to the home.